We're going to bring the meeting to order. We have a quorum. So the first order of business will be to approve the minutes of March 17th. Representative Tennis moves those minutes. Are there any additions and or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Before we get started with our house file today, I'd like to ask Representative Dill if he could give us a little report. He represented us at a conference in Chicago over the weekend, and give us a little idea of some of the things that you experienced there.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to go because this was the what is called or dubbed, it's an unofficial ad hoc group called the Great Lakes Legislative Forum, and it deals with issues on the Great Lakes. So there were legislators and DNR commissioners from most of the states, 8 states and Quebec and Ontario in attendance. The three key things that I thought were of great interest to us is that the biggest threat to the Great Lakes in terms of its water, amount of water, is diversions. And interestingly enough, those diversions are canals and things like that are dug, strangely enough, by the Army Corps of Engineers. And I think that's kind of interesting when we're dealing with all our wetlands problems and in this state that they would be the targeted one for doing diversions. Also, taking water out of the Great Lakes basin, not necessarily out of the Great Lake itself, one of the Great Lakes, but in the watershed, and then putting it somewhere else. And I'll give you an example how that would be, not that this is happening, but a mine up in my district taking water out of the ground and then exhausting it over on the other side of the Laurentian Divide or into the, for example, where I live, into the Prairie River, which ultimately would go into the Mississippi. And so there's a shortage of water. The Great Lakes are low. And so that big concern. Second item is of interest that I learned is that there are unbelievable number of ships coming and going in and out of the Great Lakes. It's just amazing. But one of the things that surprised me, there are only 55 ships that operate in the Great Lakes exclusively, that are by and large owned by mining companies and people hauling cement, limestone, taconite, and grain. And those lead to the invasive species problem. There's right now 182 known invasive species in the Great Lakes. The sea lamprey, the mussel, and the Asian carp are the three biggies, Asian carp being the third in the list of the three big. And the thing that I learned I thought was interesting is that it's not the Great Lakes fleet that's the problem. The 55 ships that are sailing around the Great Lakes is, of course, the ones that are coming in from the outside that are bringing in. And even though when they exchange their water under an international maritime law, in the superstructure of the hulls, and we saw vivid examples of that in these areas where they hold the water, the critters hang on to the structure inside or hide in it, or there's muck inside there. And then when they come into, let's say we use Duluth since that's close to us, as they unload the grain, they suck in ballast water out of the Duluth Harbor so that the ship doesn't break in half. That's essentially what the ballast water does for them, because as they unload the grain, it puts unusual stresses on the hull, so they counteract that. Then as they reload their cargo for their backhaul, now they send the water back out. And so that's when the invasive species get introduced into our water, is on the flush out when they're reloading their backhaul water. So I learned a lot about that, and it was really interesting. There's a great concern about all of the different pollutants that are going in the lake. Mercury is one of them, and it was a real learning experience. And just those are the top things that one of the things that's interesting is protecting us from even possibly more invasive species is that the Welland Canal, which is a canal that was dug, it's out on the eastern end of the Great Lakes, will only allow a ship of 730 feet in length and 78 feet in draft to go through it. So that means that the ocean-going ships, the big ocean-going ships, the monsters with the containers on them, those types of things that you see pictures of in movies or see them in harbors when you go to the coast, they can't go in, they can't come into the Great Lakes. Now, just to give you an idea, a 1,000-foot Laker, which is the largest ship on the Great Lakes that's sailing in the Lake Carrier Association's fleet, 1,000 feet, that has, that needs, during the course, as they unload their cargo down at the steel mills, down in Chicago, they have to take in 6,500 gallons of water for one of those ships. So we're talking about huge amounts of water. Even the smallest ships are over 1 million gallons of water just for one exchange. So when a grain ship comes in that's going to take grain to some foreign country, there's a huge amount of water and a big opportunity to introduce a foreign species into the lake. So that's kind of my report. It was really such a learning experience. It really was good. I enjoyed it, and it was just one of those things that you're just, it's like listening to Representative Hoppe present a bill. I mean, you're just fixated on the...
It can't be that good, Representative Hill.
Representative Hill, you mentioned something about Asian carp also. Did they have some experience with
that? Well, the Asian carp is a... and they liked that one of the DNR commissioners suggested, Mr. Chair, a trap shoot on the carp. He thought it'd be real sporty. I didn't bring it up, but they thought that would be sporty. But they have down at the Chicago, one of the big diversions in the Great Lakes, one of the bigger ones, is the Chicago River and the Sanitary Canal, which runs right, Wacker Drive, right in the center, right on the loop, right by the Sears Tower. It's a big river. And there are Asian carp in there, like lots of them. And they're building this a huge electric fence. It's costing like an incredible sum of money to try and stop the carp from getting into Lake Michigan. Of course, if they get into Lake Michigan, it's pretty easy to figure that it's just a matter of time before they're up in Minnesota waters. So they are interestingly enough, they did not know that they are getting close to Minnesota from the other direction. Neither DNR commissioner knew that there had been at least some. I told them that there had been some carp discovered, at least some, in Lake Pepin here, and they were not aware of that. But boy, they are really aware. I mean, that is like huge on their radar screen. They really spent a lot of time talking about it. And some of them, they had a Chicago TV newspaper. I mean, a TV man out there filming from a boat, and during the interview, he said, "Well, how significant is this to boaters?" And then at the exact same time, a carp jumped out of the water and knocked the camera right off the side of the boat. A carp came out of the water and hit the camera on the tripod. I mean, just as he said that, it was like God just said, "Now." And so he got his answer. It was about 30 pounds. They weighed the thing. It's big.
From San Virginia.
Can we have a little conversation about this? Representative Tilton, was there talk or what are the plans? I mean, I know there are ways to deal with ballast water. But for the things that are already here, do we have major programs in any of the universities to study what might be some... biological or whatever control of things like these carp?
Yeah, Ohio, Representative Eugenius, Mr. Chairman, Ohio it seems to be leading the way on that, and they are working on some biological, like for example, a hot tub on a houseboat using chlorine to kill the germs between customers. Some type of a biological sanitation of these cargo holds, and they also have rules that talk about the salinity of the water. So, for example, in Ohio, when they're in Ohio waters, somehow they're going out there and testing the salinity of the water to see if they've done their exchange as a percentage of the water, the salinity that it can be. And if it doesn't meet those requirements, they send them back out to the ocean. and they don't let them come into the harbor. One thing that they do have, Mr. Chairman, that they're working on is a compact between all 8 states and the 2 provinces to have standardized rules, and legislation will be proposed to each state through this caucus that would be so-called, in a sense, ratified by each state to participate in some kind of a compact. So that the basic thing is that everyone is on the same page about these 8 water exchanges and how they're going to handle different aspects of invasive species and diversions. Really, diversions. And I don't understand the diversion thing intimately enough to explain it, but it's a big thing in the Great Lakes.
And I think folks have understood for a long time that we need to deal with this problem, so it's good that it's percolated up. But I'm talking about the things that we already have here, the zebra mussels and the carp. Is there a similar consortium or pact where the universities get together and exchange information? I can see that if a bunch of us put some money in our bonding bill and pushed it together, we could maybe deal with some of the issues of control biologically. With the things that are already here now that we have to deal with.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bouguinius, I think that my sense is from that meeting that the states are going it on their own at the moment. That, you know, each of them are working basically independently. We didn't talk about that a lot. Talked about more about prevention than we did curing the present problem. However, one power company gave a number, and I forget, it was in the millions of what it cost them for zebra mussel and they removal from their water intakes, and they were encouraging this group to try and do what you're saying, is to figure out how to eradicate them or mitigate the problem. So, but it was about 4 hours, and I mean, it was very good. It was worth, and I don't think it'll end up costing us a dime, because there was as it ends up, the bills are being paid by this Great Lakes, the Great Lakes Protection Fund. There's a Great Lakes Protection Fund, and they were giving the scholarships for the members to attend. So it's pretty interesting. I'd like to go again the next time. I'd love to go again.
I really appreciate Representative Dillia being willing to go up there. I thought with your legislative district bordering all along Lake Superior, you were the appropriate one, and I'm great that you worked out your time schedule to be able to do that. It's I understand how many hours did you spend on the at the airport trying to get out of Chicago?
Thanks to the snowstorm, over 6. I was enjoying. I learned a lot about Senator Rest. we had the long conversations in the terminal, sitting waiting. So about 3 hours sitting in the plane out at the end of the runway, along with all the other Minneapolis destined aircraft as well, all in a line. So, thank you.
Members, we will go to House File 847. Representative Hoppe moves House File 847. Representative Hoppe, we'll wait until after we're finished with the bill to determine where we're going to send the bill, if we are going to send the bill out of the committee. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. You're eminently fair and judicious. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is House File 847, the Game and Fish Bill. There's a whole long list of things that are in here. I will quickly hit some of the highlights, and then we can get into amendments and talking about whatever parts of the bill members would like to talk about. We also do have a fiscal note now on the bill, which I think is in everyone's packet. Just running through the summary, some of the highlights. Everything in here from minnows, fish tags, dealing with undressed turkeys, waterfowl hunting. We'll have an amendment on decoys, trapper education, some residency issues, walleye limits, the silencer or language is in here now. There's a whole long laundry list of things. And Mr. Chair, maybe it would be better to just, at your whatever you decide, to get into the amendments or take questions from members, whatever you think would be the best use of our time.
Okay, do members have questions on the bill as it's before us? Otherwise, we can go to amendments.
Mr. Chair, I think there are only three or four amendments right now.
Okay, why don't we do those, and then we can talk about the bill when we finish with the amendments.
Any particular order you'd like to see the amendments in?
Okay, your choice.
Why don't we start with 337, which is the deer stand, the Hackbarth Amendment with deer stands.
Representative Hackbarth moves Amendment 337. Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an amendment that we did see in the Environment Policy Committee. It was quite extensive. It had to do with cutting saplings and cutting shooting lanes, etc. And we didn't put the amendment in the bill, but I think we do need to address this part of that particular amendment and put this in the bill. It has to do with unoccupied permanent stands. If I went out on a state forest land and built a stand, and I came to hunt there the next morning and somebody was in it, simply says that I'm not the owner of that stand. It's a public property, and I just have to move on. And I think it's already a given that most deer hunters already do this, but the DNR would like to put it in place, and as a result of what happened over in Wisconsin last hunting season, I think we should have this in the bill. Just to clarify things.
Okay. Are there questions on Amendment 337? Okay, anyone in the audience want to speak to opposition of 337? Okay, the motion occurs on approving the House Bill 337. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think next would be the AO5-235 amendment, which is Representative Hansen, and I will be offering that for him. And I think everybody has copies of that one now.
Okay. Representative Hockey moves the 235 amendment. Representative Hockey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment right now, the way it's in front of you, is in two parts. The top couple of lines deal with turkey hunting. The bottom part is with deer hunting, resident or non-resident or tenant or non-tenant, I should say. And after consultation with the DNR and interested parties this morning, I think what we'll do is strike lines 3 and 4, which is the turkey hunting language, in order to have peace in the valley, leaving everything from line 5 on, which is the deer hunting language.
Here, so I'm happy. We'll just incorporate that into your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there any questions on Representative Hoppe's amendment as altered? Representative Jeffy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you explain why we're removing turkeys and leaving deer? I mean, I'm assuming you're talking about maybe borderlands down in southeast Minnesota, I'm guessing, with turkeys and owners from the Iowa side or Wisconsin side that own land on both sides. Why would the turkeys be causing a problem, not the deer? I think they're both avid hunting groups down there, and I'm not quite following why you're removing one or changing one and not the other.
It's so happy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Junkie. And I'll ask Mr. Boggess to come down here and give you the real answer. I'll give it to Scott first. I think because turkeys are a little bit more of a contentious issue, and we changed the turkey language last year, and we'd like to give it another year, and what we're trying to do is there are people that own, not necessarily residents from other states, but people that are, you know, a big landowner from somewhere, say, like Wilmer, that might own a bunch of farms down in the southeastern part of the state, and they would want to be able to come down. Under the law, they would have been able to come down and hunt on, you know, all of 3 or 4 farms. And I'll let Mr. Boggess explain the finer details, but with deer, it didn't seem to be as big an issue with people. There are a lot more deer than turkeys, and you don't have to get a permit. I'm in enough trouble. I'll let Mr. Boggess speak.
Mr. Boggess?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Ed Boggess with DNR Division of Fish and Wildlife. And Representative Junkie, these landowner preference provisions in statute are something that's coming over the years that aren't necessarily something that is, the DNR has been a proponent of, but we understand that there's a desire to give farmers some preference in these drawings. And we were approached initially by Representative Hansen, who wanted to eliminate the requirement of living on the land because of the scattered ownerships that farmers have these days. And we've consulted with field staff. Some of our officers have some concerns about this, some of our field officers, but we feel like the deer issue would be less a concern than the wild turkey issue if we eliminate the requirement to live on the land, simply because there is, as Representative Poppy said, there is a lot of controversy right now about the landowner provisions for the turkey license. We changed it last year to require the person getting a permit and the special landowner drawing would be required to hunt on their own land. That was to address issues primarily in the southwest part of the state. Now we're hearing from the southeast part of the state. The landowners there are very upset about that. If we further change this to eliminate the requirement of living on the land, we think that that could further aggravate that situation at this time. So discussions with Representative Hansen and Representative Poppy, we just felt like the deer one would be less controversial at this time. Maybe eventually turkeys should be looked at as well, Mr. Chair.
Just a follow-up, kind of in a different direction then. How does Iowa treat a landowner from Minnesota who lives on the Minnesota side but maybe owns 160 acres that border the Iowa? Do I have to buy a non-resident license to hunt my land in Iowa? Or I just want to, with the wars that are going on between North Dakota, Minnesota, and whatnot, I want to make sure that we're playing fair here at this point in time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Junkie. If you own land in Iowa, whether it's deer or pheasants or turkey, you have to buy a non-resident license to hunt there.
If you don't, okay.
If you're not a resident of Iowa, if I own land in Iowa or any of us did, we'd have to buy the non-resident licenses and any appropriate stamps or ankle bracelets, whatever.
Any other questions? Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who wants to speak in opposition to this amendment? Okay, the amendment 235 is before us. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with your indulgence, I think we'll go to Representative Dill's amendment, the 342 trapping amendment.
Okay. Representative Dill moves amendment 342. I'm happy. You want the bill?
Thank you, Chair Osmond. This has to do with the bill that we incorporated into 847 in an earlier committee meeting. It has to do with the previous language said that a person had to have a license, have previously held a turkey license. And so that was a bit problematic, so it's been changed now to a person born after a certain date. Seems to work better. And also this adds in unless the person has previously been issued a trapper education certificate. There were a couple different facets of the bill that was incorporated into 847 originally, and for more specific information, I'd like to have Mr. Bogus explain the technicalities of this and how this was a negotiated language between the Trapper Association and the DNR.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bill, yes, this is something that the department's been working with the Trappers Association on. They've been offering trapper education for many years, and it's been a cooperative venture with the department. We produced the trapper education manual a number of years ago and helped to establish standards for training instructors and classroom curricula, and they've been carrying on a very good voluntary program. Representative Dill's bill originally as introduced and as amended into this bill provided that a person who had not previously had a trapping license would be required to get a trapper education certificate, but after that language was added to the bill, we got to looking at our records, and we only have records of previous trapping licenses back to the start of ELS, which was in the year 2000, so the new language that's on line 6 to 9 of the amendment would provide that a person, rather than having to have a previous trapping license, it would provide that a person born after December 31st, 1989, who has not had a previous trapping license. And we'll have the records of those people that were born after that date. in our system. So this language works better in terms of being able to administer the program. The language on lines 3 and 4 was simply to, they wanted to be able to provide this instruction through either classroom or correspondence so it doesn't become a barrier to participation in trapping. And we just want to make it clear that correspondence is an allowable option for providing the course.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, anyone in the audience want to speak in opposition to Amendment 342? Okay, the motion occurs passage of Amendment 342. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Bill, the amendment passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last amendment that I have in front of me is from Representative McNamara. It's the 331 amendment regarding the mechanized, motorized duck decoys. And I think what we're doing, the language in this amendment is the same as the state of Arkansas recently adopted, and we're looking for, I guess, conformity with other states in the flyway. It would prohibit motorized roboducks. It would not have any effect on windsocks or any kind of flapping goose or duck decoys.
Representative Hoppe moves Amendment 331. Any questions from members? Anyone in the audience wants to speak for or against this amendment? Okay. A motion occurs on Amendment 331. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. That brings us back to House File 847 as amended. Representative Poppy, I'd like to go to Sections 5 and 6. What we're, as I understand it, Representative Poppy, what this is asking for is, if we have, according to the fiscal note, there's about 7 accounts that wanting to change from the appropriations process to a statutory appropriation. And can you give us an explanation as to why that would be the right thing to do?
I think I know somebody who could give a better explanation than I could, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boggess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Just to explain a little bit, these are all of these accounts that the chairman referred to are statutorily dedicated accounts in the Game and Fish Fund. They're mostly stamp accounts, trout and salmon stamp, pheasant stamp, duck stamp, turkey stamp. There's also a couple of dedicated accounts for deer and deer bear management that are dedicated portions of accounts. And these are funds that are totally dedicated, and the statutory authorization to spend these is very strict. 97A.075 lays out specifically how each of these accounts can be spent in great detail, including the types of projects and how they may not be used unless they're associated with those specific projects. Also, these are the accounts that each of these accounts has an oversight committee, an oversight subcommittee that reports to a large Game and Fish Fund Oversight Committee that is advisory to the legislature and the commissioner. Each year, the department prepares a report on the entire Game and Fish Fund and these specific accounts and submits it to the legislature, and those oversight committees review the expenditures in these accounts and issue their report to the legislature and the commissioner. So there's a great deal of oversight on the expenditures in these accounts, and there's a great deal of statutory restrictions on how they can be expended. One of the problems that we've had, we've been required to show positive balances out into future years in these accounts, and we have acquisitions occurring out of these accounts or big projects that sometimes are not able to be completed at the end of a fiscal year. So not all the money gets expended every year that we plan on expending. Also, we have to project out revenues into the future for these accounts, and that's sometimes tricky to do if we have good pheasant counts. Our our revenue goes up for our businesses, for example. The opposite can also happen. So we're always, under the current direct appropriations, we're always kind of chasing the balances in these accounts. You can see from the fiscal note and the background information, some of these accounts have a fairly substantial amount of money in them. The oversight committees have indicated the department they'd like to see those balances put on the ground and not accumulate in these accounts. We think the most efficient way to do that would be to have these just be statutory appropriations. We understand there's a reluctance to do statutory appropriations, but we feel with all the safeguards on how this money can be spent, all the reporting that's done, that these make sense for doing statutory appropriations.
Any questions from members? President Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I don't understand what is it that you can do now with the new language that you could not already do with the old language.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pennis, in terms of what we could spend the money for, nothing would change. The only thing that the new language would allow us to do is it would allow us, if there's money in that account, to be able to expend that money. Right now we've got some of these accounts with several hundred thousand dollars unappropriated sitting in the account that, unless we come back and get a new direct appropriation to access that money, we can't currently spend that money. It stays in the account. It's still available for future expenditures, but not until it's appropriated directly by the legislature.
Mr. Chair, could Jim help me? I still don't understand. Or you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pennis, Mr. Bogness, his explanation is really that they can then access any dollars in the account when they choose to. During the fiscal year would be to me the only difference. But if there are balances in the account when the budget is being set, the department could request this committee to spend those balances. So the difference is really is very minor in the decision. Under the direct appropriation, the decision has to be made consciously by this committee and the legislature to appropriate that money. The change that the department is requesting really gives that authority to determine the level of spending to the department based on the balances. So it reduces the oversight of this committee in that sense. You hear a lot about the report that was out this year. I forget by who that called it the hidden dollars and the hidden funds. It's all the statutory accounts. So there are some questions. There are significant amounts of statutory accounts within our budget. There also are guidelines on when to establish statutory accounts that are not mandatory but do exist, and there are some questions on whether or not this request meets those guidelines. I think that was one of the issues the committee had to look at in budget setting.
And Mr. Bogus, or Director Bogus, and what is the reason that you don't want to bring your request to the legislature? You'd just rather make those decisions on your own?
Mr. Chairman, we're happy to bring our request to the legislature, but over the years we've had difficulty getting the appropriations either through the administrative process or through our own process of trying to anticipate future revenues, that we don't like to see the types of balances that have accumulated in these accounts, and it wasn't that we were intending to create these types of balances in these accounts. We certainly can come to the legislature every 2 years and ask for those as long as that's within the guidelines that the administration provides to us. It hasn't been in every administration.
Okay, so that you have balances there now?
Mr. Chairman, yes, there are substantial balances in these accounts.
And so you want this provision, so I'd really prefer could I have Assistant Commissioner or Deputy Commissioner Holston come down? I don't want to put you on the spot, Mr. Bogus, and I intend to turn the heat up a little bit.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Mark Holston, Deputy Commissioner DNR. Glad to be here.
We're glad to have you there. The Deputy Commissioner Olson, can you tell me why it is that you want this authority so that you don't have to listen to the governor anymore?
Interesting choice of words, Mr. Chair. Members, what you're dealing with here is not the standard operating dollars that run the Department of Natural Resources. These are the specific stamp accounts that are specifically statutorily dedicated on how we can spend them. These are conservation dollars. Year in, year out, those funds are going to fluctuate. Some years there's going to be balances, some years there's not going to be balances, depending upon how many licenses that are sold. But again, you have laid out procedures and policies for how those dollars could be spent. It doesn't make a lot of sense, in my mind, and that's why we brought this proposal forward, to leave money in the accounts when they could be on the land doing conservation work. You have some accounts that are tens of thousands of dollars, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 worth of revenue left in the account. You have some that it's hundreds of thousands of dollars in the account. Those are opportunities that we lose, that if we had access to those dollars today, we could be out there doing something with. It's not about our fear of coming back and asking for the money. It's just really it's just having access to conservation opportunities. And that's what those dollars are dedicated for. They're not for the standard operation. We're not buying trucks with these. We're not hiring gobs of people with this stuff. I mean, this is designed, if you take out the statute book 97A and look at how those accounts can be spent, there's very specific statutory language on how they can be spent. We just felt it was a rational way for us to come forward and ask for these dollars to be, for you to give us access to those dollars to spend them.
Commissioner Olson, was there a request that you made to the administration regarding expenditure of these balances that has not been included in the budget this year?
Mr. Chair, we did not ask for the spending in the budget. We did not go and ask for those dollars to be spent down in the accounts. We asked for the authority to present it to you as a statutory change.
Okay. You've not requested the administration to spend these monies on any particular projects? Give you authorization for it to include them into this year's budget?
We did.
Okay.
And we
would you give us a copy of those requests that you made to the administration?
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. I misinterpreted what you were saying. Did we ask for... We did not, in this budget cycle, ask for... to spend down any one account or access into the account for individual dollars. We, in our budget, asked for the statutory authority to have it statutorily appropriated, therefore having us to have access to the fund completely. So we didn't ask for the... If I understand your question, we didn't ask that question.
Deputy Commissioner, the testimony was that the department has not been able to spend down the balances as you would like to do. I would assume then you've made requests to the administration to spend down those balances, and they have not thought they've disagreed with that with those requests.
Mr. Chair,
therefore we see something different in the budget than that. So could you give us the information as to what those requests were?
Sure. I think Mr. Boggess is talking from a historical perspective over several administrations, within administrations, different years, different times. Again, members, these are in out of the $35 billion budget, this stuff is left on the table. This stuff is budget dust in the big picture. These, when you round off, these are the monies left on the table. So I think what happens over time, when administrations are dealing with big picture items, these are small items that many times just get left on the table. Or there has been decisions by administrations in the past not to access those dollars or not appropriate those dollars. Whether they've been just ignored, forgotten, or a policy change or a policy not to access them, I can't speak for those past administrations. This administration has not... we have not had an issue with the governor's office or and accessing these dollars.
Okay. It's As I understand it, the balance we're talking about right now would be about $3 million.
Mr. Chair, members, if you were to look at your fiscal note, page 3 of that note, you will see the specific accounts and the dollars that we're talking about. In the licensing bear deer management program, you're talking about a $65,000 balance that's laying on the table. In the deer habitat improvement, that's $142,000 that we would be, in a fiscal year, have access to for deer habitat improvements. Waterfall habitat improvements would be an additional $35,000 in a fiscal year, having access to just for waterfall activities. There would be under current spending, a deficit in trout salmon stamp. Pheasant habitat improvement, going out and doing pheasant habitat improvement on the landscape in the farm country, would be an additional $344,000 in the fiscal year. Wildlife acquisition surcharge is almost $1 million in the year. And turkey management is $22,000. Again, you need to take out each one of these items. This is very specific statutory language in how these dollars can be spent. We don't have flexibility within these accounts and how to allocate them. So you're seeing nominal amounts, quite frankly, as we look at the big picture in some of these accounts, and some significant balances. So, Mr. Chair, for the biennium, it would be $3 million rounding it, total dollars.
I've had a lot of people come to my office to talk to me about DNR. I've never heard them say they didn't have enough authority already. So it's an interesting concept. Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. Just trying to understand this thoroughly again. So what you're saying is current situation, every 2 years, you put forth in your budget, or you had put forth in your budget, a direct appropriation into these accounts. We approved it. And the excess or the deficit in these accounts now is due to differences in pheasant stamps sold during the year. Your projections are off. Then they basically goes in the account the next year. Then we appropriate it back. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, that's right. Those accounts rise and fall with license sales.
Okay.
We try to predict or try to estimate what's going to happen in the next hunting season or two. That's what happens. And any money not spent gets reappropriated back into it, so it cancels back into the account.
Right. So, Mr. Chair, my question, I guess, would be, this is not that we don't have oversight of everything. We can always look at and ask you for information on these, but as it sits now, probably the positive from a legislative side is there's always going to be a balance or a deficit because you'll never be right on. And so it does give us an opportunity for oversight because it does show up in the budget books. If we do it the way you want to do it, it won't show up in our budget books every 2 years, and we will have to specifically have requests made to you and others to look at that. Not that you wouldn't do it, but I think that's maybe a positive right now, at least for the legislature to see that. My second question would be, have there been any discussions with these individual groups? And are they comfortable with you just continuing to appropriate it, or would they like to see a little legislative oversight or questioning every 2 years to make sure things are... Has there been any discussion with the groups at all on this, or is this just something internally you're proposing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, I can't say we've gone to every specific group. What I can tell you is, and I think this committee... you are given a report by the Budget Oversight Committee, and I think a lot of members have forgotten that there is a physical committee that meets regularly at the Department of Natural Resources. In fact, Thursday night would be a good opportunity for many members to come over to the agency, come in and sit with the Budget Oversight Committee. It's a citizens group that goes through our budget. They look backwards, they look prospectively, and they make requirements, they make recommendations. They scrutinize, quite frankly, members, they scrutinize our numbers a hell of a lot more than you do. And they report to you annually the condition of our budget. They report annually to you what's going on and their recommendations. You're in possession of that report. And I think you would see from the Budget Oversight Committee, they would make this recommendation also.
Thank you. Representative Magnus.
Mr. Chairman, I had a question. What is the wildlife acquisition surcharge? I see you're looking for $983,000. What is that fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus, there is statutorily a $6.50 surcharge on your small game license. Every time an individual buys a small game license, there's a $6.50 surcharge that is put in. Those dollars are put into this account solely for the acquisition of wildlife management lands.
Okay. Any other questions from members?
Mr. Chairman?
I mean, this is the next.
Representative Wiginius.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I don't know of your intention of whether to leave the language in or not, but if you intend to leave the language in, I would ask you to look at page 6, line 22, where it says, including but not limited to, that language always causes me to ask questions, and because it looks like you have a total list here of anything anybody can imagine, so I'm trying to figure out what's not imaginable. And then I look up on line 21 and see protection. Does this mean that you could, like, buy a trout stream or buy easements with this money?
Mr. Chair, right. Representative Wiginius, I believe that's a yes.
Okay.
Are there any other questions? Hey, what I'd like to, first of all, I'd like to...
Question on the bill.
I guess let me do something with regard to these two sections first, and then we're going to go to other.
That's fine.
Members, I'd like to delete these two sections from the bill. This issue is in the budget bill that's already before the committee, and I really think that's the appropriate place for us to deal with these issues. I think with that, we would just keep it all together into a package so as we're going forward and talking with this and assuming that they're not knowing what our position may be versus Senate's position, I think this really should be in the budget discussion and not be on a bill out there on its own. So I would move to delete sections 5 and 6 from the House file, 847. And any questions on that motion? Representative Cornish.
That's the only place that it's found in the whole bill there?
Council has indicated to me that would be the, with regard to these two provisions, there is one other, or two other sections that deal with financial issues, and we'll talk about those too, but I'm probably going to ask to have those removed also, so then Representative Hoppe's bill would not have to go to Ways and Means. It could go directly to the floor. We deal with the financial issues and just keep those in our committee and carry them on in the budget bill. But the right now it's just the sections 5 and 6 because I want to get more information on the other two sections before I make that move. Are there any other comments on that motion? Any testimony on that motion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. We now I'd like to go to sections 31, 32 with regard to fish tags, and if we could explain that a little bit to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think
I would turn that over to Mr. Bogus or the Deputy Commissioner, whoever.
I guess my question really is there anything, because this seems to be the other only fiscal implications in this bill, I would like to pull these out and put them into the omnibus bill. Is there any concern or problem with doing that, I guess is really my question. Deputy Commissioner Olson.
Mr. Chair, that's appropriate. Okay. Fine with me, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any questions on that? I'll make that motion that sections 31 and 32 be removed from the bill and laid over for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Any questions on that motion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Deputy Fisher.
Minister, again, just for the members, Thursday night, 5:30. I know you're headed in for Easter break, but it'd be a good opportunity. They'll be meeting at about 5:30, 6 o'clock Thursday night at the DNR meeting, or DNR office. Budget Oversight Committee meets. These are unpaid people. They come in and they sacrifice their time. They're committed individuals. Many belong to organizations, many of the conservation organizations, and they spend a lot of time and a lot of energy pouring through our budget, and I think it might be helpful for some of the members who are interested in our budget. And if you're concerned about appropriating of game and fish dollars, come spend some time with these people and see the dedication that they have, and ask them questions. They're a good group of people.
It happens to occur over our Easter break. I know myself, I'm leaving town, so I won't be able to attend. But I would be, if you would, Deputy Commissioner, when you're talking to them on Thursday, let them know that we're interested in setting up a hearing time where they could come in and talk to us about this issue and kind of give us their perspective on it and the process that they use and so forth, get us better informed on it. If you could work with our committee administrator, Marilyn Brick, to try and line that up, if you appreciate it.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Are there other questions? Representative Wiginius.
Yes, on page 11, where we are allowing folks to take their kids hunting with them or apply for a turkey license, I was just imagining a family with six or eight kids, and each kid gets a turkey license and goes hunting with dad and mom. So that family now has the ability to take 10 turkeys. Is this putting any kind of pressure on our turkey population that we need to know about?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wiginius, I'll let Mr. Bogus give you the official answer, but my suspicion would be no. First of all, each one of the kids would have to go out with either mom or dad. They could stagger this and go out in different seasons. It would depend on whether they're landowners or, you know, somebody that's hunting on public land. They could also go out with family friends that are adults to hunt with the kids. It would depend on whether they're hunting all on one piece of property or, you know, across the state. The DNR regulates the number of turkeys that are taken pretty well, and the almost explosion of the turkey numbers in the last 30 years has been a great success story. I don't think that this would be a problem, but it's a good question.
Sounds good.
And if it does become a concern, I'm sure that we could deal with it.
Representative Hackford?
To that point, and Representative Wiginius, and I think we'll hear from Mr. Bogus about this, they would also still be required, just like an adult does, would have to apply for a permit in order to be eligible for that license. So I don't think it's going to be a problem at all. There's only so many permits in a certain area that you can get.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hoppe, how many turkeys are there? Do we have a count at all, any estimate?
I'll let Mr. Bogus answer that. We don't have an exact count, but we have a pretty good idea of the turkey numbers. And we asked turkey hunters around the state. There are a lot of parts of the state where you can't get a permit every year because there are so many people that apply. It's a very popular hunt. On the other hand, the range of turkeys has grown exponentially across the state. We're transporting and trapping and putting turkeys into parts of the state where, you know, a few years ago, no one thought that they would live or thrive or survive. So it's growing, and I'll let Mr. Bogus give you, he's probably got an idea of the actual number.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, it would be a very approximate number, and I don't know that I know the current number, but it's somewhere in the range of probably 50,000 to 75,000 turkeys in the state. We offer a little over 30,000 permits in a year. Success rates are around 30%, so we're harvesting about 10,000 birds in a year. We have about 50,000 applications for those permits, Just to respond to Representative Wagenius' question, and Representative Hoppe and Representative Hackbarth are correct that the youth, even though the youth could hunt at an earlier age, they would still have to apply through the same system that everybody else does. So it would not put any additional pressure on the hunting of the birds. And we're hunting turkeys primarily in the spring and hunting just the males or the gobblers, and so it's really... The number of permits is more a factor of the amount of available habitat that we can safely put hunters in than it is trying to control the population of the birds.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Question on page 17 and 18, section 26, when you talk about the pheasant season. I see you want to extend that to January 3rd in designated areas. What's the reason for extending that, and what are the designated areas?
Mr. Chair and Representative Magnus, the designated area I think would give the DNR discretion on, you know, you might want to close it earlier in the northern part of the state where the winter has already been a little tougher. And one of the reasons for extending the pheasant season was, I might have my dates wrong, but I think this year, the end of the year in Minnesota, the 31st was the end of our season. I think that was on a Friday. If I remember right, and it would just extend it so that if that weekend went into January, you'd have one more weekend to be able to hunt. And again, it's not something that in other states around us hunt into January, and I don't think it would have any impact on the population.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Magnus, I just call yours and the committee's attention to existing statute, which is on page 17, lines 25 and 26. And really, this is just mirroring existing language, only setting up a different framework for pheasants. So that's existing authority. For pheasants, we don't currently zone the state. We don't have any plans of zoning the state. But I think the idea here is this wasn't originally a DNR proposal, but we like the idea. It would give us the authority. If the 31st happens to fall on, the 1st is always going to be a holiday. If it's a Friday or something, we could get an extra weekend at the end of the season. So it would give us the flexibility. It wouldn't mandate that we do this.
Mr. Chairman, and testifiers too, how about deer? I don't see anything in here. I don't know where the deer hunting season is set up, and I don't see it in here. But just a question for you. What are your thoughts? What's the DNR's thinking about the deer season?
We approve.
Mr. Chair and Representative Magnus, there are some statutory frameworks for deer hunting. They're quite broad, though, for firearms deer hunting. I think it's something like September 1st to the end of December or something like that. We can set the regular season within that. We also sought and received some expanded authority a couple years ago when CWD was found in Wisconsin, that we now have authority to set special deer seasons in designated areas at any time of the year. So, if we ever had to do that, it would probably be a disease emergency type situation. As far as our thoughts on the deer season, we do have different zones, as I'm sure you're aware, with different lengths of the season. And generally, in the intensive agricultural parts of the state, we have very short seasons, and we split them so that we can split the hunting pressure, have a more safe situation, and we can harvest deer very efficiently in that open farm country. And landowners generally don't like seasons being longer than they need to be to get the harvest that we need. So we tend to have short seasons and split seasons in the agricultural part of the state. The forested part of the state, where it's more public ownership and less intensive agriculture, we tend to have longer seasons, either a 9-day season, which is 2 weekends, or a 16-day season up in Zone 1, the Northeast, which is 3 weekends. So, but we do have authority to have much longer seasons over a much longer period of the year.
Just a comment on that. You're getting a lot of deer harvested by cars and vehicles.
in the area. And my wife hit two deer last year on separate occasions. Last fall, a good friend of mine, the tragic situation, was killed by hitting a deer, and even probably the worst part of it is one of her granddaughters traveling with her was killed too. And, you know, if you come down to my area, I'll show you all the deer laying in the ditch. So I would give you, you know, a serious suggestion. You look seriously at the deer season, especially the doe situation. Everybody's chasing these big bucks all over the place, and I mean, I've been shot down off of buildings on my farm, trying to shingle buildings or whatever, and the bullets start flying. Somebody saw a deer, a big buck or whatever, shot into my. This has happened a few times, shot into my yard. But I know I'm not going on the road in deer hunting season. But a serious suggestion, folks. There is deer laying in the ditch everywhere, and I hate to see any more tragic accidents happen. We just did a bill the other day. A friend of one of our colleagues in the house had a child die drowning, so we passed a law to require safety vests on children. I hate to see us get to that. I'd like to see you take some proactive action on the deer hunting season.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I agree with Representative Magnus. There are a lot of deer, and there are deer in our ditch, and my wife has hit two deer in the last 10 years, not in the last year, but maybe it's a wife thing, but... there are more, I am seeing a lot more too in our area, laying dead along the side of the road, so the road counts are up substantially, and I think that is a testing to the numbers out there, and perhaps we need to look at the different way to harvest. My question is, Representative Hoppe, in Section 27 on page 18, as recently as last night, I had a duck hunter ask me to please do not put anything in statute regarding duck hunting seasons. Let the DNR decide when they're going to be. They're the ones, they're the biologists, they're the... So my question is, did this come from DNR? And secondly, if it did, then why would they want to put that in statute rather than just every year allow them to do it when they want? And if it didn't, who did it come from and why?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Junkie. This particular provision did not come from the DNR. It came from Representative McNamara. We had a rather lengthy discussion in the policy committee on this. And I think, and duck hunters are split on this, the thinking behind this was if we start too early, you know, I mean, the problem is people aren't shooting as many ducks in Minnesota as they used to. And I think that the duck hunters are split out there. Some people think that, you know, we need to open up our seasons and be much more liberal. Some people think we need to have it later and smaller bag limits, and we don't want to shoot our ducks, and we want to make sure we get ducks that come down from Canada and, you know, all kinds of things. And I'll let Mr. Bogus add to this too, but it was from Representative McNamara, and it was something that he had constituents bring forward. This year in particular, I don't remember the date, but the duck season started early, and there were a number of people who thought it was too early, and I'll let Mr. Bogus finish on that explanation.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie, this has been somewhat controversial, and just to give the committee and you a little bit of background on this, all migratory bird seasons, the state has to set within federal guidelines because they're protected by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and federal law. So, and for many years, the federal framework was that we could open no earlier than the Saturday nearest October 1st. At one time, it was October 1st. It's changed a little bit over the years. A few years ago, and there's also a closing date for the southern part of the flyway, Mississippi, Louisiana, have to close by a certain date in January. And a few years ago, member of Congress from Mississippi got the closing part of the framework extended. After that, the Fish and Wildlife Service looked at the framework issue and decided that they could control the harvest with the season length bag limit, and that they didn't need to maintain the traditional framework, so they offered a week earlier on each end, starting 3 years ago. We didn't take that the first year because it would have meant opening on the 21st of September, which we thought was too early. We did take it the second year, which meant opening on the 27th of September, which was a day earlier than we could have opened under Saturday nearest October 1st. Last year with the leap year, it was September 25th. It was 2 days earlier. So we've opened twice in the last 3 years under the new authority earlier than what this bill would allow us to do. Prior to that, it's been 50 or 60 years since we did open that early. So we told Representative McNamara we could live with this language. This is basically our traditional framework for the northern part of the flyway. We do know that there's some disagreement amongst duck hunters. A lot of the harvest takes place early in the season, and people like to get out early when the weather's mild, and shoot teal or wood ducks tend to like the earlier opener, but our more avid waterfowl hunters like to have the later season opportunities, and they get concerned when we open early. They lose out on the tail end because we still are limited in the number of days that we can have. So we felt this was something we could live with. We've only not complied with what this would require twice in the last 60 years.
Other questions? Okay, Representative Peters, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate what Representative Magnus said and brought up about deer hunting. The deer hunters in my area approached me, and I've got over 500 surveys that say we need to have some changes made in deer management, particularly with the perception that there might be large bucks out there that people are chasing, but in my part of the state, there certainly aren't. And you've got these spindly little young bucks that the way it seems to be managed now is that the first one you see is the first one you shoot. And I'd like to make it such that you have to skip that first buck that you see that has less than 4 points on the side and maybe make more aggressive management of does part of the mix in west central Minnesota. But I realize that might not be the best way to approach it with introducing a bill that makes it look like I just want something for my part of the state. So I'm wondering if, Representative Magnus, you have ideas as to how we could work together on getting some changes in the deer herd management in southwestern Minnesota, because what I'm being told is that it's not a satisfying hunt in the view of many who have lived there for years, and it has degraded. There's less opportunity, and I'm aware that the group I'm working with was directed to go to the public input meeting with the DNR in my area a couple weeks ago. They might have gotten late to the process with introducing a bill, but at that input meeting, they were encouraged to seek legislation from the DNR employee that ran the meeting, Mr. Cornicelli. Then I introduce a bill. I realize it's a little late in the process, but then I had the opportunity to talk to Chairman Hackbarth and was told, and I don't disagree with his position, that it's not wise to micromanage or tell the DNR exactly what to do. But then my advocates in my area are telling me they were advised by the DNR to go through the legislative process. So if you just want to pass it off and pass it off and pass it off, I think it will eventually catch up to you. And then you have to deal with what you might term troublesome members, like me, wasting committee time talking about changing the deer herd structure and management. So, Mr. Magnus, I'd appreciate working with you in southwest Minnesota and west central Minnesota to change the opportunities for hunters on public land and not just take down the first buck that you see. Because the genetic robustness of the herd is failing in the opinion of the hunters that have hunted in west central Minnesota for several years, and maybe we could have an opportunity to grow larger bucks if you just didn't have to shoot the first one you saw.
Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, members, welcome to Deer Management 101. This is continual debate, both in the public, within the legislature, within the DNR. It is a management change, as you've heard, from a large number of deer populations in certain geographical areas. If you have watched, if you hunt deer, you will have seen a lot of opportunities by the department to try to encourage people to harvest more deer.
to knock the numbers down, to deal with Representative Magnus's issue and Representative Junkie's opportunities of shooting up to five deer. That's a lot of venison in the freezer. And we've had some areas where we've had a lot of people take advantage of that. In the first year we proposed that, a lot of people took advantage of that. But one of the issues we're dealing with is in those geographical areas where we have large populations of deer is non-residents to that geographical area getting access. We hear knock the numbers down, well, here are the permits. We're not seeing people shoot the does the way we want to see them shoot those. We're not seeing land open up for others to access who want to shoot those deer. There's a lot of competing interests out there. And so those are things that we're going to be struggling with. Mother Nature hasn't cooperated with us in the last 5-6 years with big, heavy snowfalls and severe winters to naturally knock those numbers down. So the hunter's going to have to fill that void. To Representative Peterson's questions of rack management, it's something we're dealing with in the agency. We had a bill that was introduced by Senator Stump last year and passed, requiring us to go out and do public comment. We're getting a lot of comments from the public. How do you want us to regulate and manage bucks? Do you want to regulate people? Our biologists are looking at it from the science in health of the deer herd. Where is the deer herd at? How should we as the agency manage the deer? And do you want to bring the police powers of the state in and tell you what you're going to shoot out on that deer stand? Is it a deer with 3 points or a deer with 4 points? Is that the appropriateness of the legislature? You're going to have that debate. And in the agency, we're trying to do that. So, yes, Mr. Cornicelli, as you brought up, Representative Peterson, he looks at it as a social issue. He looks at it as a social issue of telling the hunter, you shoot a buck with 3 points or 4 points or 5 points or horns outside the ear, bring a bill to the legislature. Have it debated there. That's an appropriate thing to do. You have to decide, is it appropriate to tell us and bring the police powers and send our conservation officers out there to ticket people for shooting a deer with 3 points on one side or 4 points on one side. This is the cultural debate we are in, and the deer hunting community is thrown into this, and they're debating it right now. And it's going to take us a while to sort it out.
Sounds like a great subject for the policy. That's why I tell again.
Mr. Chairman, Deputy Commissioner, I usually don't put an oar in the water in these hunting debates. Yeah, it's a good thing. But I listened to Representative Magnus and talking about the folks who were killed, and then I hear from Representative Junkie about his wife hitting two deer. And I'm sitting here and I think, well, my son hit a deer. He was fine, but the car was a mess. And then I'm thinking about the insurance costs of all of this and wondering if DNR has talked with our insurance, because there's another social interest here that has not been put on the table that we all have, and wondering if you have talked to the insurance companies and what they've said to you.
Well, Mr. Chair, before the DNR answers, I'll weigh in on this. The place, and you know, I know there are a lot of deer in southwestern Minnesota, and there are a lot of places where, you know, frankly, not enough does are getting shot. But the area where we have the biggest problem is in the metro area, places where deer can't be hunted. And you have a lot of cities that are having struggles trying to do this. And I get, you know, I'll agree with Representative Osmond that this is probably more properly a discussion for the policy committee. But I think it would be wise of us in the policy committee to take a look at, expanded archery hunts in the metro area, something like that, to try to knock down some of those numbers, maybe ban deer feeding, to try to get the numbers down. There's, I see deer literally, I see deer literally almost every day. And most days when I see them, I don't see one or two. I see 10 or 12 or 15. And, I think my car is ugly enough they don't want to hit it. But
I'll turn that over. Now that just hurts Representative Dill. I'll turn it over to the department for the official response, but I think that's a good point. I think it is something we should talk about in policy.
It's as concerned as I am about the cars, be a motorcyclist and be out there and go deer.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative
Dill. Well, I just had a fleeting thought here. Maybe Representative Cornish and I could work to amend the Beaver control program to apply to the deer.
We're going to end up blasting on that. Blowing deer up in.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lagini, is this. We are keenly aware of the assurance rates. We were aware of the numbers and what's going on out there. We are in the process of, we've got a number of proposals that we've taken out to the public, expanding the deer range, expanding zone opportunities. We're talking about a special antlerless deer hunt in the North Metro and up in the Northwest to knock those numbers down. It's something that we are going to be exploring as many different opportunities as we come and going out to the public and talking about to them. And you get into, again, the debate. Numbers, quality, they all come in and they all have different kind of answers. It's something that, again, it's going to take us a while to sort out unless Mother Nature helps us out.
Mr. Chairman, can I follow? Just a quick follow-up on that. I'm glad you've been talking with the insurance companies, but it would be, I think, interesting for all of us to know what they are saying that this adds to their cost. And if you could share that with us, not now, but at some other time.
We, Rips, I'm happy we have your bill before us as amended. And I believe it should go. I talked to staff. I think that we've taken care of all the fiscal implications, so therefore go directly to the floor, if that's all right with you.
That's fine with me. Thank you for your help with that, Mr. Chair.
And I would like, though, to have an understanding that if the statutory appropriations issue comes up in a conference committee, we have an agreement that you'd deal with the chair on that in that issue, because I'd really like to deal with that in a budget bill, not in side bill.
Mr. Chair, as you know, I'm frightened to do anything without consulting you or Representative Hackbar. So,
right.
I appreciate that.
With that agreement, we'll let your bill go on. Otherwise, we'd hold it into the budget bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your time.
The motion reoccurs on House File 847. Be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
Members,
we have. You're very welcome. Members, we have the supplemental budget changes have been added to your books, so that those are there for your review. Tomorrow there will be three bills scheduled for hearing, and of course Thursday and Friday we are off, so we'll be back after next Wednesday, or a week from Wednesday. After we get, we'll be here tomorrow, and then we'll have a big break another Wednesday. So, there's any other issues that need to come up before us today? Today? Okay, I guess we do have one other item for us. Is Department of Agriculture here to brief us on some items in the governor's supplemental budget that pertain to our agriculture? I didn't realize that was there. If you can give us a quick overview of what the supplemental did, I believe it's fairly simple.
Sure will. Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Perry Osnes, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Ag. There are two items in the governor's supplemental budget affecting agriculture, and the reason they were included in the supplemental budget is that they're based off of some recommendations that came out of the local siting committee of the Livestock Task Force, and that committee was charged with making recommendations to the governor on ways to improve the local siting of animal agriculture while retaining the local control. And those recommendations did not get to the governor until January, and therefore we were not able to include them in our regular budget. Real briefly, there's basically two items in there, one of which would provide $100,000 per year to the department to provide resources and information to local units of government on land use issues affecting animal agriculture. There's a request by the committee that the department can play a role in updating a planning and zoning guide for animal agriculture that we put together 9 years ago. Also utilize some of the research information that's been developed over the years, the updated feedlot rules, making sure that all that is put together in information that hopefully can be useful to local governments that are looking at doing planning and zoning affecting animal agriculture. The other thing that comes into play on this as well, as I'm sure you're aware, is that we're seeing increasing conflicts going on in areas kind of in the fringe of the metro area related to urban sprawl. And I think one of the concerns that the committee had was making sure that local units of government have the necessary information that may be available to help them make sound land use decisions that can hopefully protect some of the agricultural land, even though there is sprawl continuing to move out of the urban areas. So that would be $100,000 per year in the budget, supplemental budget. The other item is a one-time appropriation that would go to the Department of Agriculture, and we would contract with the University of Minnesota on odor research. I'm sure you're all aware that odor always becomes an issue in terms of siting livestock operations, and I think we want to make sure that proper decisions, good technology is available, good information is available. The department has been involved for probably the past 10 years on odor research with the University of Minnesota, and the request then was made to provide an additional $220,000 one-time dollars to build on that research and use that research, make that available to local units of government that are making land use decisions affecting animal agriculture.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity. Members, we are adjourned.